Hi, my name is Gunnar Froh and I'm your host on the Wunder Mobility podcast. Welcome to the Wunder Mobility podcast. I'm Gunnar Froh, founder and CEO of Wunder Mobility, and this is the show where operators in shared mobility talk to other operators about the things that actually move our business. My guest today is Slavko Bevanda, and if you've worked anywhere near European car sharing in the last 20 years, you've intersected with his work, whether you knew it or not. Slavko spent 5 years as Chief Product and Technology Officer and then COO at ShareNow, the merger of Car2Go and DriveNow, and still today, I believe, the largest free-floating car sharing operator that this industry has created so far. And after that, he ran technology and operations at Digital Charging Solutions. That's one of Europe's largest EV charging platforms. Today, Slavko is the Chief Technology and Product Officer at Nectra, the Vienna-based company that's, as he's describing it, providing the intelligence and the muscles for fleet operators. Nectra sits on top of the fleet management platforms that operators are already running, and it's adding the intelligence layer that decides what each vehicle should do next. And then StreetCrowd, a gig-based execution network that gets this work done on the streets. I'm not going to spend a lot more time walking through the CV, but I would like to cover three sections in our conversation today. And one is what you actually know about running free-floating car sharing at scale that isn't on a conference slide. Some of the sort of key decisions and metrics for people to keep in mind. Two is exactly how Nectra works. Maybe we can dive into some examples and numbers and really understand what this product does. And then three, let's talk about autonomy and what happens in our industry when autonomy actually lands in these shared fleets, which would probably then be a hybrid of self-driven and autonomous vehicles. And what are we maybe already missing, or what should we get started thinking about already today? Slavko, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Gunnar, for the introduction. Really, wow, putting a lot of pressure on my shoulders. But first of all, thank you for having me in your show. It's really a pleasure and an honor being here. Looking forward to the session with you.
Thank you. And let's get talking a little bit about free-floating car sharing that I think also many people in the audience are either working in or observing, interested in. And you have this deep experience first building car sharing from the ground, really scaling to multiple cities, countries, large fleet size. And then today you're working with multiple operators providing additional technology to them. And I wonder about some of the metrics that are not necessarily shared widely. And I think one of the most important in car sharing is utilization rate. Can you give everybody a feeling for at what point, at what utilization rate can free-floating car sharing start to become profitable? What are we aiming for?
Mm-hmm. Well, starting right ahead with a pretty challenging question. Thank you very much for that. It depends, of course, always, let's say, on the size of the car sharing service provider, on the setup. On the other hand side, means how much of the technology do you build your in-house? How high are your fixed costs on the one hand side? And on the other side as well, if you're consuming or buying, let's say, if you want to operate on a smaller scale, maybe, or start like this, then you have, of course, a totally different cost setup. That's one point. But in terms of giving an indication about the possible utilization rate when you start to be profitable, I would probably say it depends as well, of course, on the fleet size, but somewhere between, let's say, 4, maybe 5 to 7 rides per car per day, then you were for sure scratching the profitability or even being above it. Yeah, and that's depending as well on the city, how much movement is being in that city. There's, of course, much more music even in it. If you look into some really exciting and bustling cities, is it Vienna, for instance? Is it Milano or Berlin? Yeah.
And you mentioned some of the most exciting markets, maybe Berlin, Milan. What does great look like in these cities? What do the best cities look like in terms of utilization?
Mm-hmm. Berlin, of course, if you want to do mobility, when you prove that you're able to do it and provide a really strong service, then Berlin is for sure the city to be. Yeah? All the partners, all the competitors are there and operating as well. I mean, depends as well, of course, on the on your fleet size. But I would say looking into that, probably between 7 to 9 rides per car per day, absolutely feasible and possible in Berlin. Looking to some other bustling cities, maybe Milano, probably even more if I look into this. It depends as well on the user behavior of the customers, of course, but you can drive it, incentify it. Is it pricing-wise, steer it? Is it availability? You can launch it, and after a while, you will get there. Between 7 to 10 rides per car per day is absolutely feasible in such cities. Yeah.
And then we are talking about dense urban environments, rather short trips maybe compared to more station-based car sharing. So we're talking free-floating, shorter inner-city trips, maybe even 7 to 9 trips per day. What kind of utilization, though, does in like percentage of the fleet does that translate into, and how does it change during the day? Because I think that sounds to anybody in the industry like amazing if you had 7 or 9 rides per day, but in reality, it still means the car is empty most of the time, right? Like, what's the average, just very roughly, like rental time and then percentage utilization of such a car per day?
I mean, the rental duration depends, of course, for instance, as well on the city. If you look, if I maybe briefly move to another city, like Amsterdam, probably the average duration of a trip would be between 15 and 25 minutes per car per ride. In Berlin, where you maybe have to do longer rides through moving from a suburb into the city center, or it depends on your mobility mode you want to choose, probably more between 20 to 40 minutes, depending as well here. And Milano, probably as well, 25, 30 minutes per ride like this. To give you an indication, probably regarding the utilization rate, I would probably say something around 25 to 35% is absolutely feasible to achieve that. But you're right. If you look into it's still majority of the day where the car is not used, basically, of course. Yeah.
That's right. That's super interesting. I think coming at this whole topic from an operations angle, basically it's about utilization of these expensive assets. And even like in a best case scenario, dense city kind of well-established sharing and maybe 7 to 9 rides per day, 30-minute average trip, you know, that's basically 240 minutes, like 4 hours. So you're still at, you know, your 20 to 30%. And what else might this asset be doing in the future as it's becoming autonomous? But the other sort of driver of, I think, that success in the market is the density. And I think you guys also did a lot of work on this, figuring out what minimum fleet size is necessary and so on. Do you have some orders, ballparks, benchmarks in your head if somebody's launching a city, how to calculate sort of minimum viable fleet size?
Yeah, this depends, of course, as well on a lot of variables. Yeah, if you look into it on the one hand side of how intense is the movement across the city on the one hand side, what is about the availability and the density, of course, as well of hubs, means public transportation hubs, for instance. As well, how far away the main hubs or target destinations and origin destinations, how far away, what is the distance between the two of them, for instance. So all those things play into this account, and the density, of course, of the population is another variable you have to consider. Yeah, so for a city, maybe for a mid-sized city, you easily can launch something like 300 to 200. Maybe let's take into account Stuttgart or something like this, around 200 to 400 cars per city. Depends how much you want to drive it. To Berlin, you would for sure talk about several thousand of cars. In terms of, is there a perfect indication or a KPI I could provide or state here? Probably not. But I would say probably 5 to 15 cars per square kilometer maybe could be an indication or a range you could pick up and take into account when you're thinking about, yeah, from a free-floating car sharing perspective. Yeah, because if you want to change the mobility behavior or the mode of the how the customers are moving around, you need on the one hand side time to change this, because the customers need to get used to it, various cars, different mode. And in the end, they don't want to think about it, how they want to come from A to B. So it's all really about having an easy access and the most possible convenience here. And one part of the convenience is, of course, as well, the walking distance to a car. Yeah, it means the closer you are to the origin where the customer is moving, want to start his trip, the better. Is it, we already saw, let's say, if a customer has to walk 1,000 meters, or even more, then the willingness is already less. Or if you have a competitor with a better availability, then you probably not be able to convince that customer. So within 500 meters is 500 meters, probably the perfect walking distance. In the average, you should be able to provide your customer. But in the end, it's always a compromise you need to figure out in terms of availability, costs, and of course, the revenue you are targeting for in a city.
basically you're saying they are looking for convenience, reliability, availability. So density is sort of the operator lingo. How many cars do I need to put? But really what's driving it is the sort of end user view. What's my availability, kind of service level? And you mentioned there the willingness to walk. I always have a car for you in the city. It's just question is if it's close to you. Did you guys look at how sort of acceptance rate drops off when the car is further away? You mentioned maybe 300 to 500 meters most. Where does it drop off and how steeply does it drop off? Or does it depend again on the city and on the user groups?
It depends on the one side, of course, on the offering means one point is distance. The other point might be even, let's say, preferences regarding car models, vehicle types. Yeah, if you have competitors, maybe have more attractive cars. It's always, let's say, of course, a question of a personal, how do you say, a choice. If you want to jump on a more valuable car, for instance, then you might be even willing to walk longer for getting to that car. But in the end, I would say the perfect distance is probably 500, 700 meter. Then it already, can I state here a percentage? No, I wouldn't dare to state here a percentage, but you can see that it definitely significantly drops. Yeah, when you're far away than 1,000 meters, for instance, then it should be already a pretty strong push. Yeah, and finally, it depends as well on the weather conditions. It means if it's raining, I don't think a customer would be willing to walk 1,000, 1,500 meters to access such a car, for instance. Yeah, they would, he/she would probably more likely look for a different mobility mode. Is it public transportation or whatever? Yeah.
So there are still a lot of variables where it depends on different factors. Probably it's in the hundreds of meters that's acceptable, then it's dropping off quickly. And you mentioned this example that you often hear, maybe there's a better car and like willingness to walk for better cars and stuff. And I'm going to push back a little bit on this because I feel like this might be sort of the, you know, petrol heads talking in a way where I also would count myself as one of them. I do that, but I think that I'm not a typical consumer. And I think that the people using carsharing especially maybe are not so attached to their car or emotional. And is that really the case? Were you able at some point to see this in the data that people are walking more for specific cars? Or is that sort of a myth for the people that love this product and then create it, but the users just want proximity and availability?
It depends for sure as well, let's say, on what kind of mobility mode are you looking for. We had, for instance, in the past, when we started to offer, in addition to the free-floating minute-based car sharing or hourly-based car sharing, we extended our service to daily-based rentals, right, as well. And there, for sure, we saw that there's a specific customer group. I don't want to say it's the majority. Yeah, that's not the case. Probably more younger men, male customers are looking for it in terms of if there's a more exciting car, is it a convertible, then they're maybe more interested and willing to walk to that car on the one hand side. But across the customers, for sure, I would say it's as well, you're right. It's okay, I just want to move from A to B. The majority of them, this is for sure a fair point. Yeah, I want to move from A to B, access to car. And when we had the Smart for two in our fleet, we definitely saw that it was a strong USP, maybe from our perspective, because the car is easy to park. Yeah, you're almost able to find everywhere parking lot for such a car. And there was quite a willingness, because another pay point of car sharing service providers, of course, finding a spot where you can leave and drop off your car on a parking spot. Yeah, and the Smart for two was a very exciting and compelling car, obviously. Yeah, but it depends finally as well on the regions. Yeah, maybe in Germany it's a bit more. That might be the willingness for a specific target customer group, like maybe male customers, younger ones especially, to jump on a car. If you look to Italy, France, or other markets, there's maybe not that petrol guys as you just mentioned them, who are willing and looking for specific car types. Yeah. Very good point.
Yeah. Also, the question of the car type, is that something we sort of think a lot about in the industry? Which car will be more convenient to actually be suited and stuff? And at the end of the day, it's just whatever car you can get the best deal on, whatever you can get cheaply in the moment. Right now, I'm not aware. Maybe there is one, right? There are like 400 car sharings in Germany, right? And 2,000 in Europe or so. But I'm not aware of one that's still using the smart, even though it makes so much sense in the city. And it seems to me like the models that end up on the street, it's hard to understand what strategies behind it, other than they probably got a good deal on a bunch of those. Isn't that in the end of the day what drives which cars get deployed, just which need to get pushed into the market?
On the one hand side, and for a specific share of the car sharing operators, for sure, as you just said, I don't want to say it's all about getting cheap cars, but yes, for sure, yeah, means it's a very massive cost factor of your P&L. Means the leasing rates, cars, you buy it, whatever, has anyway a very strong impact on that. So definitely for one part. It depends always what kind of level, means how deep do you want to be integrated in the car, yeah? Because other cost factors are as well, let's say, is it maintenance costs? Is it checking the vehicle health state of the cars? And the cars are getting more and more connected. We, for instance, from Car2Go or ShareNow in the past, and Free2Move, of course, as well, what we did for us, it was very important and crucial to have a deep as possible integration into the car state to optimize the maintenance from our perspective, to keep the car in a very good shape, in a good shape as well, to run the business and ensure a strong and big fleet availability. Plus, depending as well, let's say, what kind of service or rental options you want to offer to your customers. I mentioned it briefly. It's about free-floating car rental. That's how we called it. Means day-based rental. Some customers are expecting, of course, as well, a better equipment or more options in the car. Is it a navigation system? Yeah, for instance, on the one hand side, is it an aircon or what, et cetera. So I think it depends what kind of strategy are you following. If you want to operate in a bigger scale, a deeper integration is important from my perspective to manage, take care of the maintenance costs. Plus as well, if you're offering different mobility, to sum it up, modes, then we talk as well about long-term car rental. Then you probably should look as well a bit for more better equipped cars.
When you say long-term car rental from the end user's perspective, that's basically pricing. I think from the operator perspective, there can be more behind it, availability and so on, if cars get taken out of the fleet for longer all of a sudden. But let's talk a little bit about pricing. From your perspective, let's say somebody's launching with, the most classic would be a minute-based pricing, and then maybe that's an hourly rate, okay? What are the next two or three pricing innovations that they should definitely do that make a big difference? And maybe is there also one that you might as well skip, that it adds complexity, but it doesn't really do anything.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, that's a tough one. Of course, I think what was for sure a very smart move was introducing as well the kilometer-based pricing from a customer perspective, what Miles did. We clearly have as well to admit, very smart, clever move in terms of as well change from a customer perspective. It's easier to calculate regarding the pricing. Yeah? So I think this is really a very interesting option. As we can see, Miles is as well very successful with it. Yeah, now picking up on your question, I think the minute-based pricing, definitely very important and very good offering. Hourly-based, yeah, clearly as well. But I think the more, let's say, the more hours you offer, is it, for instance, interesting to offer 12 or 16 hours package? Don't think so in the end from a customer perspective, yeah. Then rather jump as well and offer day-based rental. I think this is a very exciting opportunity from a car-sharing perspective to optimize your utilization and create an interesting, let's say, one-stop shop for the customer. That's basically the idea. Whatever you want to do with your when moving around a city with a car, then you want to have it in one hand, and then it's easier for you as well to keep the customer in your ecosystem. From a pure operator perspective, I think you looking into AI, it's as well a very exciting opportunity. Let's call it dynamic pricing, flexible pricing in terms of, you know, we know Gunnar, of course, as, let's say, geeks, mobility geeks, that moving a car around means getting it from A to B can be done by a customer on the one hand side. But if a customer drops a car off in a, let's say, cold zone, how we call it at Nectar, then from our means the probability is pretty low that a customer would pick it up within a relatively short period of time, then it's better to relocate the car. And you can steer this, incentivize the customer as well with dynamic pricing, means getting the prices down to incentivize the customer to do the relocation, or optimize as well during peak zones, let's say of the day, your margin with somehow driving up the prices in a reasonable way, because you always should keep your customer in mind, because mobility customers are as well, of course, very price sensitive.
Maybe final question on this section from your perspective, how important for the operator profitability are these upsells? Let's say reduce your deductible, any kind of options that might be living at the beginning of the rental to purchase additional packages.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's from an operator point of view, I think, a very exciting and interesting opportunity from my perspective, and from a customer perspective for sure as well, especially probably if you're going to do a longer rental. Is it 1-2 day rental? It's of course as well a personal choice, but we offered in the past always, let's say, the customers package. Is it an insurance package, for instance? Yeah, to avoid the deductibles, as you just said, on the one hand side. So it depends on the customer, but it helps you, of course, to cover your costs. And from a customer, it gives them as well a pretty good feeling. Means everything is covered with a reasonable price. You can go for it. And I just learned, even let's say from that CDB, for instance, what they're doing is charging on each and every rental a fair price, means per ride, roughly 50 cent, something like this. And the customers accept it means as well for the insurance coverage, and all the possible damages, accidents are covered as long as you don't abuse, means you're not driving while you're drunk on the one hand side, or you're causing strange reason by speeding or whatever an accident. This is of course not covered, but a very smart idea from my perspective. It's not so painful from a customer perspective, and if you calculate your business and understand it, a very good easy point.
I think that the impact this upsell has on the revenue is not so spectacular maybe, but it could be quite spectacular on the profitability, because, for example, if your average cost per trip might be, let's say, 10 euros and you're putting a 1 euro reduce your deductible on top that people can opt into, that's 10% more revenue, but your margin on this 1 euro might be 50%. It depends, but it's not unrealistic. And your overall margin on the trip might go from 50 cents to 1 euro. So basically, you're only 10% more revenue, but then doubling your margin on the trip. So I
exactly
think
mm-hmm.
like we are like trying to give this optionality a lot in different parts of the user flow to maybe offer more ad sales. I want to move over to talk more about and learn about Nexture and the product, how it works, and also the impact that you are seeing so far. And I want to just describe quickly for the audience what Nexture actually does. It's not a full fleet management platform, but I want to ask you later why not. Maybe would that also make sense? It's sitting on top of one at the moment, and it's two products: the intelligence layer that predicts demand and tells you what to do next with a given vehicle, and then the street crowd, which is that gig-based execution network. And both can also run standalone. So, with that out of the way, Stavko, on the intelligence layer first, can you describe what data it's ingesting and what decisions it's returning?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course, happy to do so. I like the analogy you brought up at the beginning. Exactly. I think what is unique about Nexture, we're combining the muscles and the brain, means muscle, let's talk. We are using the Street Crowd app, where we have access to our crowd community and building them up and taking care of our users. On the other hand side, with intelligent, means the brain, means our database, our algorithms and AI engine we have developed. And that's basically unique in terms of optimizing, reducing the idle times, of course, of a car sharing operator on the one hand side, and driving up the revenue, on the other hand side. Means what are we doing? We're considering various mobility data across the city. Of course, we are analyzing, let's say, the mobility data the customer is handing us based on their historic data. We're creating and using their operational area they have defined on the one hand side, analyzing the movement they have provided us, considering movement data across the city, operating area of the customers, and clustering and breaking it down in, let's say, in really small zones. And this is not a standardized approach in that case that we have all of them are the similar size. It really depends on the geographic technical setup of a city, length of the street, where the specific no parking zones. So it's really individual, tailor-made for each and every customer, for each and every city. Considering that, we are optimizing and analyzing where are in real-time mode all the day, the biggest movement across during the day on the one hand side, and where and defining cold and hot zones means where the probability is well pretty high that a follow-up rental would happen. Yeah, and based on that, we are, can collaborate and work together with our street crowd to organize and manage the relocation with a very reasonable price across the city on the one hand side to drive up the revenue and make sure increase the probability that a follow-up rental would happen on the one hand side. And we can bring in as well the dynamic pricing approach we have as well developed, what I tried to explain a few minutes ago, means as well support our customers, not only together with our street crowd, as well based with our intelligence, to drive up the revenue on the one hand side, reduce, of course, the costs, optimize the cost structure with our street crowd service, and finally reduce the idle times of the cars and the assets of our partners.
Can you give us a bit more feeling for what data you are using? So I guess it's going to be impossible to like list all of it. But for example, how many data points or what are individual data points that maybe are obvious and maybe less expected? Just give some examples maybe of what you're pulling in.
Yeah, of course. What are we pulling in is on the one hand side, of course, movement data for our customers. We're taking mobility movement data from mobile network operators to understand the movement across the city. We're considering weather conditions on the one hand side. We're looping in as well, let's say, geographical data like transportation hubs, yeah, public transportation hubs, etc. Events which are happening across the city. And so what we're considering as well is that there are a huge, very important soccer event, etc. on a specific date. All this is changing and influencing. It's really like a vivid thing you can see when you look at the movement of such a city, which is depending on seasons, on daytimes, on weather conditions and events, of course. Yeah, these are probably the most important ones. Yeah.
And with what you are doing, I think prediction accuracy is sort of the make or break for this kind of layer. And what's possible today for you? Do you measure this somehow? Can you give us a feeling for how accurate your demand prediction would be 1 hour out, 6 hours, maybe 24 hours out? And what can that practically be used for if I had this information then?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course, let's say the demand prediction we can provide, it's individually for each and every day during a week. It's a different one over the weekend, for instance, in comparison to a Thursday or a Wednesday, of course, on the one hand side. So, and it's we're permanently optimizing and changing it with all the factors, considering all the factors I just mentioned. And so what is the accuracy? Easily, let's say 24 hours ahead, we can steer it and optimize this with our 4 hours. Our customers.
I'm not sure how to, let's say, quantify this. Maybe like correct me what metric you're using. But for example, if you would say we're talking about a specific area and my prediction is, well, in 24 hours at this time window tomorrow, there will be demand for, let's say, 10 rentals coming from this zone. Like how accurate would this forecast be? Will it then in reality turn out to be between 9 and 11 or more between 5 and 15? How do you talk about like demand accuracy? Mm-hmm.
I would say in terms of accuracy, probably around, it's of course always a bit, but to give you a roughly a range, probably be around 10, 15% like this. So maybe probably 9 to 11. Let's assume, as you just said, we predict 10, probably 9, 8.7, something up to 11, 11.5, something like this. And we clearly can see across our past customers that we are able, in terms of driving up the revenue between 25 to 50, 60 percent, something like this, together means relying on our demand prediction service, yeah, and the relocation service we are offering.
By enabling them to fulfill this latent demand that
exactly
you had predicted, but that they couldn't see in their own trips so far, because of course it was unfulfilled. And you went straight to the 24-hour mark to say maybe even there it's like plus minus 15%. I was expecting kind of that it's sort of getting less and less reliable the further into the future, right? But it seems like even 24 hours is not such a big challenge to predict. Would that be?
Mm-hmm. True, absolutely. The more data you have, and the more accurate your data model is getting, and this happens during a period of time, means we're getting smart as well with each and every day here, with each and every week, the more accurate we're getting. And I think if I may jump briefly back, what I forgot to mention about what are the variables or factors we are considering, the app openings is as well a thing we are considering. It depends on the partner, of course, as well. If they're supporting us with this is a very good point to measure this in a very accurate way as well.
And what are the dimensions, so to speak, that an operator has available to now try and match supply and demand when he has this prediction? So, of course, your street crowd could be one solution. Maybe I was always going to say like a last resort, like the most manual intervention, maybe also costly intervention. What other tools would they have available to respond to this intelligence now?
Of course, what are other tools? On the one hand side is really a flexible pricing engine. It depends. We provide that service, but I know as well partners who are doing it by themselves. That's definitely a thing I would recommend in terms of playing around with dynamic pricing. You can steer and support your customers as well and basically utilize them as well to optimize your service. Maybe we can even phrase it like this. And a second thing is, of course, on the one hand side, fleet size. It depends. Means what are you driving for? It's a cost factor with the fleet size, but the better your availability is, the better is probably the more higher is as well the probability that the customers will change as well the mobility mode, because you will become a consistent part of their daily movement or weekly movement on the one hand side. And the last variable for sure is as well you need a specific customer size, and this is very difficult looking as well when we started maybe 2011, 2012 with Cardigo. Car sharing was a total completely new business. Nobody was aware of what is car sharing. So we need, what I want to say here is we need much more time to get to train the customer, to explain them, or so maybe not even explain, so that they got used to the service. What we are offering means having access to a car. That was a very exciting thing. Today, it's a totally different story because everybody more or less knows what car sharing is. And now it's a question of availability. But nevertheless, you need, of course, to a relatively strong and good, strong and big customer base to make sure your service is operating in a very, in a reasonable, economical, reasonable way from your perspective.
So you mentioned to respond to this demand forecast and try and help match supply and demand, they have the tools in their toolbox. One is pricing, dynamic pricing. You guys are also providing this as an intelligence layer. If the client allows, if they wanted to, you can set pricing dynamically for individual vehicles. The challenge with that, I imagine, is different from ride hailing. We don't know where the user wants to go. So we can only incentivize to please move away from here. This is probably not a good area. They might end up in another bad area or even in a worse one. Is that still effective? And is that still definitely the number one way of responding to demand forecasts? It's just lowering price in definitely unattractive areas? Or are there other dimensions for pricing that I'm not thinking about?
Of course, that's for sure one point. Absolutely right. I think what, of course, it's not always a pleasant factor, yeah, but you can, it's as well about talking about drop-off fees, yeah. It depends to the target destination. Let's, for instance, assume you're moving to the airport. I think everybody understands that the airport is a relatively expensive area. Means, of course, there we charge them an extra airport fee. And I think this is normal in the meantime for all the car sharing service operators. And on the other side, as you just said, if there's maybe some areas, let's call them a cold zone, means probability pretty low that they there will be pretty soon follow-up rental, then you can charge them as well with the drop-off fee, because you don't want to cut off that operating area for different reasons. Yeah, this is as well an interesting factor. And looking into the probably not so pretty close future, because you said ride-hailing a strong advantage, they can enter the target destination. If I look into, let's say, the strong development on the car side, means with all the APIs the car manufacturers will provide in the close future, means there is as well from a pure car sharing operator perspective, the opportunity to optimize that car rental in terms of the car sharing ride, so that you could put in as well your target destination, because you want to combine with different trips here, or our car sharing app would have access to your calendar. It could offer you something. There could be a restaurant you want to kind of drop by, etc. So the better we understand the customer movement, means let's talk about personalization, the more opportunities we will have as well, the car sharing operators will have as well in their hands to optimize the business on the one hand side, but provide the customer as well a much better experience.
So you're talking about not just discounting certain cars that are in cold areas, but having an opinion about where this user probably wants to go this morning. Because he did that many times in the past, so he probably is going from home to work, and I know where his work is. And if that's a location I want the car in, then I'm sending him a promotion. But not everyone who's opening the app will automatically see that discount. That's future talk, right?
Or yeah,
that's
absolutely.
Not today, right?
Okay. No, not today. Yeah. Unfortunately not.
Okay. Yeah, but it makes a ton of sense. I also wanted to spend a few minutes on this sort of second part of your product, the muscle, the gig-based street operations. That's been a topic for a few years also in micromobility, and Bird, Lime, Tier have built versions of sort of gig workers, and there have been sometimes problems with it. It still persists until today, and I wonder how you are setting this up to keep the workers reliable and accountable, because as an operator, if I have this need, will it really work in the moment?
Mm-hmm. This, of course, as well, let's say, a very important factor. Looking back to my time when I was working as a car sharing operator itself, having access to operators means workforces on the ground was pretty difficult. Doesn't matter if we were relying on our internal team members on the one hand side or collaborating with external partners. It was always having access to enough workforces and the high fluctuation the partners were facing in that very specific business. Yeah. So, and this is where our AI plays comes as well into the effect on the lecture side. Means we're driving up a big community depending on the partners and on the needs in the city. Let's, for instance, take a look at Berlin. We're talking here about street crowders of roughly 5,000 our community with roughly 5,000 street crowders here having them on the street. In excess, let's say, not on the street. And it's pretty similar to car sharing. Yeah, you have a specific amount of power users on the car sharing business and pretty the same on the street crowd community. You have a relative small percentage where they say, okay, they're pretty reliable. They want to really do business here and combine it as well, maybe with a convenience factor. Means, hey, I have to move anyway from A to B. Let me check in the app if there would be a car available from a car sharing service operator. I can do that ride and even earn a bit of money. So it's a win-win situation. Yeah. So it's really about a simple, and I don't want to say simple, but it's a question of mathematics, statistics. The probability is simply much higher that there would be someone who can pick up the car and do the relocation. Do we give a guarantee? No, but the probability is pretty high, and we can see it works out.
You said the probability is pretty high. So are you measuring the reliability of that street crowd in a kind of fulfillment rate? Like what percentage of jobs that operators are posting there are actually getting done? And how high might that realistically be?
Wouldn't like to share as well here, let's say, a percentage on the one hand side. But of course, yeah, we're definitely tracking on the one hand side, how good are we in terms of driving up the revenue of our customer, of our partners on the one hand side, how many of the relocations are we able to fulfill based on our demand prediction model. If we see it's too low, then we will definitely try to optimize it on the one hand side. Yeah, means drive up the community if we see it lowers or it's not enough. So it's as well an active steering what we are doing on the other hand side. And of course, because you asked as well the question, what else are we doing? It's of course we're trying for customers, for our customers in that case. It's very important that they're happy and satisfied as well with the quality we are doing. Means how long does a ride takes on the one hand side? Is the car dirty afterwards, for instance? These are all the car sharing operators important questions and points we are monitoring here as well. The quality and the assets, how does it work? And try to are educating our community and driving as well a specific code of ethics across our community to make sure everything works out for both parties.
I think that some people might have hesitations about as an operator relying on a community approach in terms of reliability. So can you give us like a feeling for like what reliability level is realistic that you are aiming for? So you don't want to say numbers, but for example, I guess it's not going to be like a 50% of the tasks get fulfilled, right? You're aiming like, is it fair to say over 90% or like right around there?
Around this, I think would be fair, definitely what we are striving for. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. I imagine there are certain events where it's then not possible after public viewing or so, a ton of jobs are coming in, but most of the time it will be. You already touched before we go there, one to close the loop on the Nexture product. You mentioned impact early on, maybe 50% revenue uplift. You have examples of that, even 70% in some case, but like a very meaningful, super sizable revenue uplift by better matching supply and demand. Can you comment on like what the cost side looks behind that? Because I would be worried that, yes, I can fulfill all this one if I do like a ton of manual relocations, but then I might actually be losing more money because I'm not making that much revenue as the relocation is costing me. So is that profitable growth? If my revenue goes up 50%, how will my cost go up at the same time?
Can I give you here a range? And on the one, yes, of course. Just thinking about thinking loud, let's say. Of course, what we are doing, if you compare us, let's say, with a normal service operator, we are for sure having a different price proposition on the one hand side. We will be more attractive than, let's say, a normal service operator on the one hand side. So from a cost end side, of course, we will be more attractive. This is one point. But what we are taking care of course, as well, we're not doing relocations to optimize our business. That's not the approach how we are working. We are really trying to optimize the revenue uplift or the ROI for our customers. Means to find the balance. We do it in a close alignment with the customers here because we don't want to overdo it. So means let's try to support them, especially when we ramp up a new customer. We're taking enough time, several months to spend on that, explain them, show them the figures and going up step by step, because what we clearly don't want it. We want to avoid the cannibalization of possible pure revenue optimization, original car. Means we definitely want not to cannibalize normal customer rides. That's not the approach how we work.
And I think you're phasing this in close collaboration with the operator to achieve profitable growth. And I think that part of the uplift comes from the elements like dynamic pricing that you mentioned, and relocation is actually like a very still expensive, through your street card efficient, but still sort of expensive intervention, and that you are only doing probably not to gain a single ride, but to move a car out of an area where now it's flowing in the system again. Before it might have been there for another day and you're actually losing out on 5 or 7 rides. Now you're bringing it to another location again. So I think that's a really interesting kind of dance that you're fulfilling with the operator. And amazing to be able to have not only the recommendation, but also the execution.
Absolutely. And I think what's another good point, it's not only about the costs we should take into account for the relocation itself. I mean, it depends where the car is parked. Let's assume the car was left at an airport, for instance, incredibly expensive or inexpensive parking areas. Then it's much smarter to do a relocation, optimize as well the parking costs for our customers. This can be easily a business case by itself. Yeah, I know it by heart. Let's say the airport relocations we did at Chernow, it was a really very important pillar on our hand side to optimize our costs.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we can spend a few minutes towards the end on your outlook towards autonomous vehicles, maybe teleoperated vehicles, mixed fleets, and so on. We've just had a number of conversations around this also in the last weeks outside of this podcast. And what do you consider a realistic timeline? And do operators, car sharing operators in Europe, have to do anything today already? Or is it just fair to observe and keep checking in on it, but no need to act this year yet?
For autonomous, you mean, right?
Or teleoperated. The advent of vehicles that can also relocate themselves. Mm-hmm.
I think it definitely makes sense to look into it about the traction or regarding the traction. I think it won't happen tomorrow, but maybe in 2-3 years in a bigger scale. That's what I see. So as a car sharing operator, you might have the feeling today, oh, we lost the battle or the race in comparison to the ride-hailing companies. If you look at Uber, Lyft, Waymo and all the other ones. But it's definitely worth to investigate into it. Teleoperators, I mean, as well. It's about relocations on the one hand side, or maybe even optimize the last mile concept, means drop off a customer at the target destination. The teleoperator autonomous car could do finally move away right away, would solve the biggest pain point, finding a parking lot on the one hand side, or reducing, let's say, the walking distance to the car. This is for sure a strong thing. And from a car sharing perspective, from my point of view, it's really about, you know, as a car sharing operator, how to manage a fleet, how to steer them. Is it about maintenance? Is it about how many cars do you need to operate a city in a sustainable way on the one hand side? And you shouldn't underestimate to have access to the car means customer identification. Make sure that that customer who is entering the car is your customer. Means from a security point of view, I think there's a strong advantage on the car sharing operator side. We're looking at those strengths, definitely worth to invest into it and be pretty bold in your movement and thinking into the future. There's a way for car sharing as well.
I think that many people in the industry have to be, or everybody, let's say, to be fair, has to be very careful with the investments they're making. It's a like low margin industry, so you don't necessarily want to be the first to test some innovation and then it was too early. But it could be also good to be a second mover on many of these things. But you don't want to be left behind. So if there are a few dozen car sharing operators in Europe that have more than 500 vehicles, maybe 30 to 40, I think, across Europe, how many of them do you think will have at least one autonomous or teleoperated vehicle in their fleet next year? Is that just the first two most sort of curious ones, or most people will have that? And if you don't have it, you are risking to fall behind next year.
Next year, that's pretty close. So I really think it's only a few ones, maybe 2-3, who could do this and are brave enough to do this. Because as you said, it's a pretty tough market and a tough business, car sharing.
What do you think these few are most trying to learn? Where might they gain an advantage if they now had this for a year? And even if it's a very super small scale, right? Just a few vehicles, but what are they maybe learning that others are not learning?
Mm-hmm. Well, the biggest learnings from my perspective, on the one hand of perspective, it's first of all not maybe a learning, but it's of course PR, very lots of attention on the one hand side. But the biggest learning is for sure in terms of utilization, how we can make sure that the customers are having access to the car, how does it work, having as well the first learnings, how does the customer perceive, and what might be the impact on their business, keeping in mind the walking distance to the car and as well the parking lot. These are the biggest pain points from a car sharing perspective, and this is for sure a biggest learning. And then finally, we touched it as well at the beginning, you need a critical mass of vehicles if we want to do car sharing. Looking into the future with autonomous cars, the number of cars will have to decrease on the one hand side due to the price, but even because the availability will be a totally different one, because the cars are moving permanently around. So we will have as well a first step, an indication, what does it mean on your P&L in terms of number of cars and assets you will need to operate such a business.
Wow, yeah. super interesting, super fascinating topics from my perspective, like for anyone who's in the industry. Thanks a lot for sharing so openly, metrics that could be considered normal, the way you're making the actual product work, and also kind of a realistic assessment on maybe the timeline of the advent of these newer vehicles, where my takeaway is it's still okay to also just be talking and observing. You're not late to the party if you don't have one in your fleet yet. I think continues to be super interesting, and I can see how the economics will change and also the user experience will change when these vehicles actually come. I think the markets we can be addressing will be much larger. And I hope that we get a chance to reconnect and check in on this in the coming months and years as that's unfolding. Thanks a lot for being so generous with your knowledge and with your time.
Thank you very much, Gunnar, for having me here anytime. Looking forward to follow-up discussions. Yeah, it was a pleasure being here. Thanks a lot.
All the best.
Same to you.